Thank you, Andrew and Claire. I know we'll be saying that more than once in the next few days. Andrew has told you, I'm Linda Peterson. I'm Vice President of RSVP, and this year I chaired the Colby Committee. The Robert and Vanetta Colby Prize is given annually to the book that has made the most significant contribution to the study of 19th century periodicals. The Colby Prize was endowed, as many of you know, in honor of one of our most devoted members, Robert Colby, and last year it was renamed to include Vanetta, another distinguished scholar of periodicals and more broadly Victorian literature, two people who have influenced and indeed personally supported many of us in this room. I want to acknowledge the help of my wonderful fellow committee members who were thoughtful, rigorous, and also prompt in their responses. So Alexis Easley, Dal Little, Sally Mitchell, Joanne Shattuck, and I were the members this year. It was a true pleasure to read for the prize. We had excellent nominations, all of which taught me a great deal about 19th century periodicals and Victorian culture. We unanimously chose Patrick Leary's The Punch Brotherhood, Table Talk, and Print Culture in Mid-Victorian London for the award. Now, Patrick asked me not to say anything about himself in this introduction, not even that he's a PhD in history from Indiana, nor that he's the founder of the Sharp, nor that he was a co-founder of Sharp, nor that he's the current president of RSVP. On all these issues and many more, I must remain silent. So instead, I thought I would read a couple of comments from committee members that sum up the Punch Brotherhood, about which I've urged Patrick to speak today. First comment, this book makes a significant contribution to our understanding of Punch and the mid-Victorian periodical press. I admire Leary's approach to investigating the Punch network and situating the study of individual contributors within the context of the Brotherhood as a whole. He vividly recreates the table talk associated with the circle, its scandals, rituals, etc., and provides significant insight into the functioning of the periodical itself, especially the large cut. Of all the books I read, this one focuses on periodical media in the most substantive and illuminating way. Second comment, this book was far ahead of all the others. It is mature, scholarly, wide-ranging in its grasp and presentation of mid-Victorian literature and culture, and of masculine literary life in particular. It's not just about the Punch Table or the Punch Brotherhood. It's analysis of what Leary calls the contested borderlands of oral and print culture in Victorian life is truly original. And Patrick is now going to talk more about those contested borderlands. And I'm sorry if I embarrassed you by reading that, but it's only fair repayment for the restrictions you put on me.
Thank you very much for that very kind introduction, Linda. I was trying to follow in the tradition of anonymous Victorian authorship. I'd like to thank the Colby Committee. I should say, in my presidential capacity, thank you all for coming very much. And if I start to thank Andrew and Claire and their colleagues, we won't have any room for this talk at all. So I'll do that later, more appropriately. But I'm so glad we're all here together. It's going to be, and it already is, a wonderful conference. I want to thank Linda and her colleagues on the Colby Committee and the Research Society for Victorian Periodicals for what's really a splendid honor. This means a lot to me. And I'm especially pleased because it is, as Linda was just saying, in honor of Robert and Vanetta Colby, who were such stalwarts of this society and such pioneers in our field. Years ago, when I first began looking at Victorian authorship and periodical authorship, I relied a lot on the Colbys. They were an unfailing source of their work, and then personally were an unfailing source of information and insight about authors' relations with publishers and all sorts of other things, the way that authors shape their careers. And they had an expansive view of our mission. Because, you know, our field, as reflected in the title of our society, it's a society name that we're kind of stuck with. You know, it's a sort of slightly donnish whimsy involved in this name. But it sounds to non-specialists like a very narrow field. And even to some Victorians, you know, I'm going to that Victorian Periodicals Conference. Yeah. They think it's very narrow. But what the Colbys knew and what you and I know is that there's nothing remotely narrow about what we study. It's as broad and as varied and as rich as 19th century culture itself. It reaches into all aspects of that culture, and its study illuminates not only Victorian society, but very significantly our own society. And in fact, the breadth and variety of periodical studies, so amply reflected in this wonderful program that we're embarking on today, posed a real challenge for me when I was trying to decide what in the world was I going to talk about for this Colby lecture. You know, our field is just moving in so many fascinating directions, and there's so much to talk about that I was suffering from a kind of logjam. And fortunately, I was bemoaning this dilemma to a friend, an RSVP colleague, and she said, "Oh, you know, you should just talk about your book. Nobody will have read it anyway." So you might as well take this opportunity to tell them something about it. And I thought, yeah, I could do that. I thought this was a sobering and very useful piece of advice. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the nuts and bolts of it, because I always find it interesting when other people talk about that and about what they did and how they did it, and pick out a few parts of the argument and examples that I hope you'll find interesting, and end with a few lessons learned maybe for future work. There are a lot of people here who've written books. Some of us here have written lots of books. And I think they would agree that every book is a kind of a journey. You know, you really don't know when you start out where it's going to take you exactly. And you don't know how long it's going to take you, often to the despair of your publisher. And in this case, it was kind of a long journey. The last time and the first time that I talked about Punch at an RSVP meeting was at the Vancouver meeting in 1998. When my beard was still a becoming shade of brown, I should have. So it's been quite a while. I didn't start out, though, to write about Punch. And in fact, in my heart of hearts, I really don't even think of this as a book about Punch, really. I think of it as a study of authorship and about the relationship of orality and print culture that uses Punch as a case study for that. I'm interested, as Linda was saying, in the changing and fiercely contested and fiercely policed boundaries between what could be said and what could be printed. I want to restore this sense that all of these activities, all this journalistic work was happening in a sea of talk, you know, a sea of talk that spanned both work and leisure. That happened at the workplace, on the print shop floor, that happened in the editorial rooms, and at dinner parties, and around club tables. I'm particularly interested in this sort of homosocial environment, which very specific kinds of talk. And of course, the relationship between that and what winds up in print, and how things move from print back into the conversational lives of the Victorian middle class. This and the matrix of complex rivalries and allegiances through which all this talk moves and that shapes this talk, these remain my focus in the book in many ways, and they remain my focus in what I'm working on now. I have been looking at different communities of authors around different periodicals, like Fraser's Magazine, for example, and Notes and Queries, and some of these authors that were associated with particular periodicals. And one thing that really struck me about Punch was how cohesive they seemed as a group compared to a lot of others. And also by the role played by the weekly dinner meeting that they had every Wednesday night, the editorial meeting, in the operation of the magazine. Now, this was a long tradition, as many of us know. This was a long tradition in periodicals. Here's this famous Maclise drawing of the Fraserians. You know, there's McGinn presiding over all these guys at table. A lot of these people never actually contributed to the magazine, or there's something very semi-fictional about this depiction. Nevertheless, this itself derives, of course, from Blackwood's and the Noctes Ambrosiani, and this whole notion, this whole idea that these journals come out of a kind of a tavern culture. And certainly, Fraser's grew out of that culture. But as I argue in the book, it was a culture, at the dinner meeting that is, was a culture that changed significantly when Bradbury and Evans, who were printers, very successful printers, were asked to come in and basically rescue Punch. It had been kind of an authors and illustrators and engravers collective, but it was losing money. And they were asked to come in and rescue, become the proprietors, become the publishers, which they did. And when they did that, they made some very important changes to what had been a pretty freewheeling group of people at local taverns, working on a bunch. Some of them actually worked for the magazine. Others were just hanging around drinking and making jokes. And so it was all rather loose. But they changed it. They moved it basically from a more leisure and more environment to more of a work environment. They put it on the premises of the publishing house. It was hosted by the proprietors. It was attended by the proprietors. And it was specifically for deciding what was going to go into the magazine the following week. There's no real good picture of them at table, unfortunately, for the period that I'm working on. This is for some years later, around the 1890s. The contributors sitting around the table, there's Frank Bernand. A couple of these people were there in the 60s, like John Tenniel and George Du Maurier. And then there are pictures of some of the honored dead here, Thackeray and Lennon and Taylor and Charles Kean, for example. The focus of the dinner meeting was the creation of the large cut, which was the full-page political cartoon that appeared in the center of the magazine. And both physically and in many other ways, this was central to Punch. The large cut was was what kept it, in their eyes, from being just a miscellaneous collection of drolleries. They were really, it was their serious commentary, satiric commentary on the passing events of the day. And you get this sense from Doyle's covers. These covers are all missing from the bound volumes, of course, for reasons you all know. Iconographically, it's very interesting. And of course, you can see, Mr. Punch is using Toby as a model for the British Lion here. He's basically creating the large cut here on the cover. A lot of what I was trying to do, and the reason I call this talk Lost Voices, was to try to restore a sense of the multi-vocality involved, the many voices involved in this meeting and in this collective authorship of the large cut and other things about the magazine, as well as reflecting more generally on these boundaries. I was very struck when I first began investigating Punch by the richness of surviving manuscript records. And you know how it is. You tend to gravitate toward things where there's really good evidence, and that's what happened to me. The ledger books, for example, for Bradbury and Evans' publishing business, including Punch, but all the books they published for Dickens and Thackeray and many other people, still survive. There are a lot of letters scattered all over the place. And there are diaries. Speaking of diaries, brings me to this pleasant-looking old chap, whose name was Henry Silver. Henry Silver... you don't get too much more obscure in 19th century journalism than Henry Silver. He published nothing under his own name until he was just almost this old. And then it was just a couple of articles in the Art Journal. But he labored for decades writing things for Punch. And he was on the staff, beginning in 1858 up until 1870. Now, he took the place of Douglas Jerrold when Douglas Jerrold died. Well, of course, Douglas Jerrold had been had been the voice of Punch in many ways. He'd been the radical voice. He'd been very pugnacious, very witty, just a legendary figure. When he died, Silver was called in to take his place. Silver, on the other hand, was a morbidly bashful person. He was incredibly shy. In fact, became notorious at the table among his colleagues for punch for being silent. He just never, almost never said anything. Which, of course, was the whole point of the dinner meeting was to talk, right? And Silver was, he was shy to begin with. He felt intimidated by the company. So he just never said anything. But he did something else. Since he was sitting there silent, he decided he would scribble down some notes about what the other chaps were saying. And he put these together in what he called his diary. Now, it's not really a diary. It's just in the sense of an account of daily activities. It is an account of these dinner meetings. He was proud of two things in his life. One was having gone to Charterhouse School, to which he left this portrait when he died. And the other was having been on the staff of Punch. And when he died in 1910, he left that diary to Punch, along with a few other things. Now, I had heard about this diary. I'd come across bits about this diary in footnotes. Gordon Ray's biography of Thackeray and Arthur Udrian's book about Mark Lemon and a few other places. Some of those couple of popular books about Punch that came out in the 60s. But almost everything had been 30 or 40 years before. You know, and I thought, well, where is this thing? Why hasn't this thing been published, and where is it, and can I get my hands on it, and all that sort of thing? Well, I won't go all through that. If you're curious, ask me later. But I asked Richard Altuck, seemed like a good place to start. I've been corresponding a bit for some years, and because I knew he was working on a book about Punch himself, and he told me about it, and long story short, Punch had changed hands a couple of times. It was now, what was left of it was owned by Muhammad Al-Fayed, who had moved all the archives and everything into an office near Harrod's, which he also owned. But everything, the Silver Diary, as had been true on the old Punch premises since 1910, was kept in the vault, as if it were radioactive. It was not allowed to be published. People could look at it, you know. What's fascinating about this, let me show you a page of what he was doing, because what Silver was doing is a really astonishing record, because what we're getting is he was really focusing on what people said at the table just in terms of gossip and dirty jokes and things like that. And then on the large cut, the various ideas being tossed around for the large cut. There are some dirty jokes in the book, by the way. Perhaps not as many as there should be, but they are a very interesting part of this whole sort of raucous gathering. Here he is. Here's how he looked when his beard was younger too. At the time when he joined the table. And here is a sample page of the diary. I thought you'd be curious. I didn't choose this because it was typical. I chose it because it was short enough to fit on a slide, so that you could see the structure of it, which I think is kind of interesting. So he's got the date at the top, and then he has the initials of everybody who's present around the table. All right, so there's E for Frederick Evans, one of the two publishers, JL for John Leach, Henry Silver, Fred Evans, Evans's son, Shirley Brooks, about whom I'm going to talk a little bit more later, very interesting figure, John Tenniel, Mark Lemon, the Falstaffian and beloved editor of Punch, who was really great at managing this difficult group of people, Percival Lee, very, very obscure comic writer, medical training, Charles Keene, the artist, Frank Bernand, who later became editor of Punch for many years, and William Bradbury, Evans's partner in the publishing business of Bradbury and Evans. Then you have this part, this first couple of paragraphs here, is the discussion basically over dinner. And he's just, what I can gather is that he was jotting down notes, and he would transfer the notes to this notebook afterward, okay? So this is, there are no food stains on the diary that I've been able to find. So he didn't take the book with him, which would have been pretty conspicuous, actually. And it's unclear if people actually knew. I don't think they knew he was doing this. Another story. But he records all this miscellaneous talk. And then LC, Every entry, there is an LC in the left margin, and that is the beginning of the large cut discussion. Now, in this case, it's not much of a discussion. In most of these, it goes on for at least a page, sometimes more pages than that. This happens to be about the Schleswig invasion. There's this whole Schleswig-Holstein affair, which is so complicated nobody understands it. And they're having a lot of trouble presenting it in a way that their readers will understand what's going on. Shirley Brooks says, and you'll notice that he indicates who says what with initials. So he says, well, Britannia and Master Bull, you know, let me go. I can't see those two big bullies pitching into that little fellow. And then Leach says, amends it to the cut of John Bull between two princesses. Sometime ago, he suggested some other thing, two politicians after dinner, slurring the words of Schleswig-Holstein because they're so drunk. And Mark Lemons says, you know, we should really do a cut about the improvement of laborers' cottages. So that's the whole discussion for this. Okay. Just in case you're curious, this is the large cut that results from this, done by John Tenniel. At this point, Leach really hates doing the political cartoon. He just leaves it to Tenniel. But he often has ideas for the large cut. And like so many large cuts, you know, it involves a domestic setting. You see this in a lot of the cartoons for Punch. You know, a lot of it is the schoolroom, the parlor, the racetrack, the railway carriage. They use Dickens characters. They use Shakespeare. A lot of what they're trying to do is to anticipate reader reaction. They want to fend off rivals. They don't want to imitate any of these rivals that are increasingly active in the 1860s, like Fun and Tomahawk. In fact, there's one instance in which Tenniel refuses to do a cut with a skeleton in it because Fun had run a cartoon with a skeleton just the week before. He said, no, it's going to look like I'm imitating Fun. What they're really trying to do is get what Mark Lemon calls a punchy cut. And I thought a lot about it as I went through these, and there are some 350 entries over these years that deal with all these cartoons. Is what's a punchy cut? And I think what Lemon means by that is something that's funny and topical, and as Henry Silver put it, combines two ideas. So what they would do typically, and this happens week after week, is that you'd see they take something in the news that was non-political and they couple it with something that was political. So, you know, Chang and Eng, the Siamese twins, are appearing at Egyptian Hall. There we go. So you have Gladstone about to separate the Irish Church and the English Church. So you know they did this over our Siamese twins. Okay, they did this a lot. this topicality. And the reason for this, I just stuck this in here because Du Maurier, who became the main, was brought in after Leach died in 64, did some of the big cuts, and he liked to do these funny drawings. And here's one of himself at the table waiting to hear from the writers. This was very much a writer-driven thing. The writers are deciding on the cut. He's sitting here smoking, waiting to be told what to do. So that's PM for Pawnee Mayhew, Horace Mayhew, Henry's brother. S for Shirley Evans, Fred Evans, John Tenniel, Mark Lemon. Usually there were more people around than that. And this is the knife. Traditionally, when the large cut was decided, whoever thought it was decided would toss this knife into the center of the table and say, there's the cut. Okay. So topicality, of course, is part of what makes a punch cut punchy, according to Mark Lemon. And it was sometimes difficult to achieve. I think we all find in studying weekly periodicals, certainly, and newspapers, that topicality becomes more and more a kind of holy grail. The scoop. You know, how can you be more topical than your competitor? And there's all sorts of technological hindrances to being as topical as you'd like to be. And there's an interesting instance that happens in 1866 when Prime Minister John Russell has a bill before Parliament, sort of a proto-reform bill. The dinner happens on Wednesday night. It has to be, the cut has to be to the engraver in time to be printed on Saturday. So what the problem was, they knew they had to do something about this bill. So they decided they would do it on Wednesday night. But they didn't know whether he was going to win the vote or not. The vote wasn't going to happen until Saturday. So what they did was to do this. So John Tenniel went ahead and drew this and had Joseph Swain engrave it, leaving out the caption, leaving out anything on the paper, and leaving out John Russell's mouth. The idea being that if he lost the vote, they would turn his mouth into a frown, and they'd add an appropriate condolences kind of caption. And if otherwise, they would turn his mouth, the corners of his mouth up. Well, sure enough, he won by 5 votes. So Saturday morning, Tenniel goes in, adds the smile and the caption. One thing you also see around this large cut discussion, of course, there's a lot of this in the book, is that there's conflict. It's multiply authored. There's a lot of disagreement about things. Horace Mayhew is really the last representative of the Geroldian Henry Mayhew radicalism of the early punch of the 1840s. And he disagrees with pretty much everybody else about the issues of reform and enfranchising the working class. The whole Governor Eyre controversy, I'm sure a lot of you know about that, the savage repression of a rebellion in Jamaica and Eyre's subsequent prosecution really split the staff. Brooks was in favor of, wanted to do pro-Eyre, Governor Eyre pieces. Tom Taylor would have nothing to do with it, and so on. The American Civil War was one of these sources of disagreement. I should say, what I was trying to do in writing about this was to, writing about these large cut cartoons, was to try and avoid doing it in a thematic way. Not that there's anything wrong with that, and there are people in this room who've done a wonderful job with thematic analyses of punch cartoons. But traditionally, you look at it and you say, well, all right, well, take these set of topics, and what does punch say about this? About women's rights or reform or whatever it is. Take the topic and follow it up. And that can be very useful. But what I really wanted to get away from that, because I wanted to emphasize how the process worked, irrespective of what the theme happened to be. And as I said, once again, to restore that sense of this being a collective, multiply authored thing. Anyway, as I started to say, the American Civil War was one such source of disagreement, and the absence of one of the voices can make a big difference. And this happened when Abraham Lincoln was assassinated in 1865. Shirley Brooks, Charles William Shirley Brooks, who nobody remembers today, but who was actually rather a power in literary London in the 1860s and 70s, early 70s, and a very respected periodical journalist, he couldn't come to the meeting that night. He had some conflict with it. So he wasn't there when the news came down about Lincoln's death. Now, Punch had been very severe about Lincoln. They had ridiculed him unmercifully for a couple of years, at least. And so they did this cut. Britannia sympathizing with Columbia. Very mournful. And on the opposite side of this, on the other side, they had these verses by Tom Taylor that were extravagantly remorseful for the role that Punch had played in demeaning and belittling Abraham Lincoln. When Brooks saw this the next week, he was furious that the guys at the table had decided to do this. He says, "Punch can do no wrong. You never admit that you're wrong. This was, this was bad for the magazine. It was a bad policy." Interestingly, Brooks had been one of the few people around the table who actually supported the North during the war. So that was he was anti-slavery, which couldn't be said of John Leach, for example, and some of these others. But it was a good example. This is a good example of conflict where the presence or the absence of one voice can make a great big difference. I should say that they did a lot of cartoons that were about much less exalted subjects than this. Because this is the weekly process. One thing, you know, usually you see these punch cartoons and they're on a cover of a book or they're illustrating the Second Reform Bill or the Crimean War or something, and you lose the sense that you're having to churn these out every week, you know. So by following Silver's diary, you get this wonderful sense of political iconography from the inside out as a weekly operation. One of the things every now and then that appears in the, not very often, it appears in the large cut, are some of the rivalries among literary journalistic people that are the subject of a lot of the talk. I mean, a lot of the talk before they get down to the large cut discussion is about what other people are, how much money they're making writing for this or that periodical, how this or that periodical is doing, you know, what their sales might be, things about their editors. This is a world that is riven with conflict. Because each of us tend to work on one periodical or one author at a time, I think we often lose a keen sense of what a competitive marketplace this is, and what it must have been like to work as a journalist in a marketplace like that, even if you have a relatively stable staff position at a periodical like Punch. But there are a lot of these small controversies. And another point I want to make on this is that it actually matters. I think these rivalries matter. The sort of disagreements of authors and these little controversies among authors are often treated as basically a source of humor, and they are frequently funny. But they actually reveal the fault lines of power relations within the literary London, within the journalistic profession, in ways that I think are very interesting. Now, here is an example of payback on some journalists that the Punch people don't like. There was the 300th anniversary of Shakespeare's birth committee, the Shakespeare Tercentenary Committee, which was headed up by Hepworth Dixon, editor of the Athenaeum. And Brooks and Taylor and other people at Punch had been on the committee. They didn't like it. They didn't like the direction it was going in. There were a lot of Dickensians on the committee at a time when there was a lot of conflict between Thackeray and Dickens, which I'll talk about in a minute. And they felt that the committee had snubbed Thackeray, who died at the end of 1863. So, and they resigned in mass, and there was a letter of protest in the Times and all this sort of thing. And so this is their comment on this, are all of these guys down here, the pygmies down here, who think they're memorializing Shakespeare. And of course, you know, Brown, Smith, Jones, and here's this fellow writing Athenaeum up here. That's Hepworth Dixon, presumably. But Silver says in his notes about this, you know, actually, we had to be pretty restrained about this. Gilray would have done it as little dogs pissing against the statue. This reflects a lot of the gossip that's going around the Punch table about rivals, and if you look at Dickens and Thackeray at this period, and look at what happened between them and how that affected Punch and how that affected the whole literary world, you really get a sense of how this rivalry really matters, how it has real world consequences. You know, Bradbury and Evans had been publishers of Dickens for quite a long time, But they'd been his printers and they were his publishers, but their families knew each other. They had a personal relationship as well. And in fact, Charlie Dickens, Charles Dickens' son, was engaged to Bessie Evans, Frederick Evans's daughter. So they were very close in every sense. All of this came crashing down in the summer of 1858. And I devote a chapter to the summer of 1858 where I talk about the Dickens scandal and this breakup with Bradbury and Evans and the Garrick Club affair as complexly interrelated events that happened during that summer. And basically, if you don't know, what happened is, of course, Dickens had fallen in love with Ellen Ternan. He decided to separate from his wife, and he decided to issue this extraordinary public statement about the separation, forever after known as the personal statement. And he sent this thing out to the Times, and he printed it in Household Words, and he sent it to all these other newspapers, explaining the reasons for his separation and asking people to stop gossiping about it. What's extraordinary to me about it is that he's really using the medium of print culture to try and squash talk. He's not trying to get people to stop printing things about it, because nobody had been printing anything about it. He didn't want people to talk about it. Well, as you can imagine, it had exactly the opposite effect from what he intended. And there were some very funny reviews of this in the journal saying, what in the world is this about? What's going on? Now we want to know all about what's going on with Mr. Dickens and his life. But Punch did not print it. He didn't ask them to print it, but he assumed that they would print it, which was an extraordinary assumption when you think about it. They're going to have this, all these jokes and comic cartoons. In the middle, they're going to have Charles Dickens' statement about his marriage. Somebody who never even wrote for Punch? What's going on? So anyway, he was furious about this, and he shut down all relationship with Bradbury and Evans. He didn't attend his son's wedding. He didn't, you know, he wouldn't have that woman in his house. He left them as publishers. He closed down Household Words. And then turned around, opened up All the Year Round. And Bradbury and Evans started once a week in competition. So here was a rivalry, if you will. This was a set of personal relationships involving gossip in a crucial way that had very significant consequences in the literary world. I mean, it really made a difference who got published and where and all this sort of thing. Gossip, of course, was also increasingly commodified during this period, and you just need to look at the regular columns in so many periodicals, especially from the 1850s onwards. You'll see all these columns about gossip of the studios, talk of the town, echoes of the club, and so on, that promise that you'll have access in print to the normally private world of conversation among sort of cultural insiders. And the Garrick Club affair was exactly concerned with just this boundary. And basically, Thackeray, Edmund Yates, young Edmund Yates here, looking very dashing, prints a, he was a devoted, a sort of a disciple of Dickens, and in a fugitive publication called Town Talk, published a really nasty article about Thackeray. The week before, it had been a profile of Dickens and how wonderful Dickens was, and the following week, it was about how awful Thackeray was, and how cynical his conversation was, and you know, and how his popularity was fading, and all these nasty remarks. Somebody called it to Thackeray's attention, and also the authorship. Anyway, long story short, Thackeray engineers his expulsion from the Garrick Club, of which they were both members. On the theory that he'd only known Thackeray at the Garrick Club and that this violated the privacy of club conversation. Well, this turns out to be quite an interesting story, and in researching this, I found I was looking at the minutes of the Garrick Club itself, which nobody apparently ever looked at for this, and it turns out that they had, months before all this happened, been very concerned about exactly this thing, that people were taking gossip out of the dining room of the Garrick Club and publishing it in these kinds of journals, and that they needed to put a stop to this. So this was part of that policing this boundary between print and talk. This is what Town Talk looked like. This is the issue that this Thackeray thing appeared in. It didn't last very long, maybe a year or two. Let's see. Let me give you a similar example, though. Fast forward a couple of years. William Makepeace Thackeray has been hired as the editor at a princely salary for the Cornhill magazine that George Smith, publisher, started. And Smith holds these big dinners for contributors. These are important sites of literary networking. And I know there's a number of papers in the conference this weekend that are about these networks. And I, too, am fascinated by these networks. So Trollope is one of the people invited to these dinners, and he's so excited to be meeting all these other people and these other editors, and it's great. He's writing to the Cornhill. He the hero worships Thackeray and so on. He makes the mistake of telling a story to a couple of men about this dinner he went to with Thackeray and these people. Unfortunately, one of the men is Edmund Yates. Yates is a special correspondent to the New York Times. He's making, picking up a little extra cash, selling gossip to the New York Times. Entitled Echoes from the London Club. I mean, here's a man who's been kicked out of a club for passing on club gossip, and he's embracing it with Echoes from the London Club. This is a good story of Thackeray. Well, this was not a good story of Thackeray. It was a lousy story of Thackeray, but it was mostly about, it was designed to make George Smith, the publisher, look bad. It was all about Thackeray makes some joke about Johnson, and Smith doesn't get it, and this shows how Smith is just an uneducated tradesman, and blah, 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 you know. It's just a nasty little story, but it appears in the New York Times, and then it is picked up by the Saturday Review, which uses it to bash Thackeray and the Cornhill. So this is Yates getting his revenge. Well, when all this happened, and all this came out in Saturday Review, Trollope was mortified. He had to go to George Smith and say, I was the source of this story. I'm so sorry. Smith was furious. And he stopped having these dinners. He just stopped cold having these contributors' dinners. So this networking site, which was quite an important one, I think, in many ways, was just shut down as a result of this incident. Another example where gossip has consequences, it has real-world consequences in the literary world. Trollope never forgave Yates, I should say. This is also, just incidentally, a really good example of the transatlantic flow of gossip, which I know something Bob Nicholson is interested in, I'm very interested in. I think it's something we're going to learn a lot more about, a lot of transatlantic flow of information as we use these new digitized collections to essentially track things. You know, the culture of reprinting that you see within Britain and then overseas. It's something that is really easy and interesting to track. It's like injecting dye into a circulatory system, and you can follow it all around to where it goes, to provincial papers, and so on. But part of what's interesting about the American versus British aspect of this is that, as Joel Wiener is, I'm sure, writing in his new book and has told us in the past, there was a huge difference between the American press system and the British press system. And the British felt, rightly so in many ways, that the American press was vulgar. It concentrated on personalities, it was filled with the most licentious gossip, all these terrible things you would never print in Britain. So, of course, what you would do if you were the Saturday Review or various other papers, you would say, well, they've done it again. Look at this terrible gossip that the American press, you know, they're just the most licentious people, they'll just publish anything. And here it is. There were exceptions to this, though, and it's very interesting to track the Dickens scandal in this way, because there are some very interesting ways in which it flows over there and then flows back. A later statement he made, basically blaming his wife explicitly for the separation, goes first to the New York Herald and then comes back to the English papers and does terrible damage to Dickens' reputation. However, a specific mention of Ellen Ternan goes to America via these special correspondents I want to know much more about these special correspondents who are sort of hanging around the clubs and whatnot in London and flogging their information to American newspapers. That stuff goes over to America, but it stays there. It doesn't come back. So Ellen Ternan doesn't get mentioned by name in connection with the Dickens marital gossip. And this is why it was such a shock in the 1930s when suddenly Ellen Ternan as Dickens's mistress became a cause celebre. Oh my God, we never knew about this. Well, the readers of the Banger Daily Whig and Courier in Maine knew all about it. They could read it. But British people never. So this is just part of this circulatory system that I find very interesting. But what I want to conclude with is talking more about what I think of as the matrix of relationships in which all these little texts, all these little paragraphs are embedded. Personal relationships, social, professional, political, financial, that reflect the overlapping associational lives of the people involved in creating Victorian periodicals and newspapers. What you might call the human metadata of these complicated textual objects. In making sense of these, I think we need a new history from within, one that's rededicated to contextualizing them by means of this matrix, a matrix that, like gossip, like talk, is ephemeral and still largely invisible to us. I mean, it's true that we very rarely have the information necessary to reconstruct what happened. I mean, you know, it's only because it was such a famous incident and there were a bunch of memoirs about it that we happen to know that Yeats wrote this, for example. Nevertheless, just being mindful of the causal power of those relationships changes, I think, how we look at the texts we're analyzing. Just as we need to be aware that there's this sea of talk that is vanished now, but that made a difference in how people wrote and what people's relationships were like. We also need to be aware of these relationships. It's like, even if we don't know specifically what they are, you know, it's like an astrophysicist sees a wobble in the orbit of a planet and thinks, there must be something else there that's causing this. Sometimes you get that sense as you look at the evidence for some of these things. I'm going to give you one last example. Shirley Brooks, whom I mentioned before. Shirley Brooks I became fascinated by and wound up writing a chapter about him, and I'll probably wind up writing something more about him at some point. When they brought out the silver diary out of this vault on a cushion, being careful not to touch it because it contained all these dirty jokes and things in it. They also brought, this is Amanda Jane Doran, who was head of the Punch Library at the time, also brought these other two volumes. They were bound volumes, they were calendars, as it were, you know, business diaries, essentially, with a page for each day. And one was for 1869, one was for 1872. And she said, I thought you might be interested in these two. These were in the vault. Well, they were Shirley Brooks's diaries. And they turned out to be, in their own way, every bit as illuminating about the Punch Circle as Silver's diary had been, and about very much more. It also set me on a quest to find out other surviving copies of his diaries, and ultimately, so far, I found 8 of them. There are 3 at the London Library, there are a couple at the Morgan in New York, there's one at Harvard, and I'm always hoping that another one will surface at some point, because he kept these all his life. And when he died, his ne'er-do-well sons just flogged them to the local booksellers, and that's why they're just a few that are scattered here and there. As we know from these diaries, Brooks spent a portion of every weekday morning and evening reading through a tall stack of newspapers and magazines. And he read them in a way that we don't read them, and I think it's important to try and reconstruct a little bit how he read them and why. He's looking for things he can use, first of all, in his own writing and his own editing. He's looking for things for Punch. He's writing for the Illustrated London News. He's writing for a colonial audience in Home News. He writes for the Bath Chronicle. He writes for a lot of the Era, very active with the Era that we're going to be hearing more about. He's looking for gossip that he can retail and comment on. He's looking for out-of-the-way facts. He's looking for expressions of political opinions that he can disagree with or applaud. But more than anything else, he's looking for the merest hint that somebody somewhere has criticized him or one of his friends or allies or Punch. He's scouring it. He's scouring the pages for this. For example, he found... when the editor, let's say, there was an article in the Daily News that offended him. There was about an incident at the Garrick Club at which he was sort of a power at the Garrick Club. So he wrote to the Standard and said, you know, it was the Daily Telegraph. He wrote to the Standard and said, would you like a response to this? I said, oh, sure. So he sends off a counter slash, as he calls it, which of course appears the next day. A lot of what we see in newspapers and magazines has this kind of backstory as his back. It's a weekly stream of answering commentary, log rolling, score settling, designed to intercede in what was a very competitive literary, artistic, and theatrical marketplace. And this is a reminder that even after the egregious era of puffing had passed, still in the mid-Victorian press, It was still a world in which behind-the-scenes machinations accounted for by interested parties governed much of the promotion and criticism of books and plays and paintings. And machinations that the prevailing system of anonymity helped to conceal from the public gaze. Now, Brooks's diaries are just full of these, and I'm just going to give you a completely typical example. Here is Brooks, by the way, who's considered a very handsome fellow. And he was basically Henry Silver's opposite. He was as voluble as Silver was silent. He was as successful in a general way as Silver was not. He was just a very influential and interesting journalist, and quite typical. And part of what I argue in the book, incidentally, is that his Tory opinions have a lot more to do with the growing conservatism of Punch than this general notion that Punch people just sort of got older and more conservative. That's sort of true, but it's also true that it's because he became the leading voice. He was renowned as a conversationalist and a vocal polemicist. That he became the leading voice at the table, and then later editor. Here's a typical entry from his diary. Hepworth Dixon, you remember Hepworth Dixon, writes to ask me to do anything I can for his book on America, and to prevent the echoes of the week in the Illustrated London News from abusing it. These are, or were, done by H. Friswell, who has been slaughtered in the Athenaeum, and may be supposed eager for revenge. I wrote to muzzle him, and to H. Dixon. Well, now here we have a set of relationships, okay? Now let's we've just unpacked this for just a little bit. Hayne Friswell had indeed been badly slaughtered in the Athenaeum just 2 years before in a review that we now know is by John Doran that was so scathing that it was the talk of the town for a while, and Friswell's defenses and those of his supporters appeared in the Publisher's Circular and the Illustrated Times and the Morning Star and the Examiner and lots of other places. Friswell was convinced that this review in the Athenaeum was itself a payback for his having resigned from that Shakespeare Tercentenary Committee. Okay. The whole episode left him bitter. Now, the reason Dixon is writing to Brooks is that Dixon has made things up with Brooks, who was also critical of that committee, and resigned from it. He'd made things up with Brooks, and he knew that Brooks was a big power at the Illustrated London News. He wrote leaders for the Illustrated London News at this period, and he was really in with the Ingrams. So he wanted, and he knew that, he probably knew, that Brooks was about to start his own column in the Illustrated London News. So he wanted to make sure that Friswell didn't get his licks in this Echoes of the Week column. And as far as I can tell, he didn't. We don't have the letter, unfortunately, that Brooks wrote to Friswell. But he did suppress this, and in fact, the Illustrated London News ran a fairly respectful review of Hepworth Dixon's book on America. Now, it seems to me that countless paragraphs in the newspapers could be, and for that matter, in diaries like this, could be explicated in exactly the same way. And one thing that has really struck me as I worked on this, and as I continue to work on this, trying to understand these networks and these communities, is the enormous emotion that is coursing through these networks. Love, hatred, envy, ambition, desire, joy. They're all here in what I would call, echoing Raymond Williams, structures of feeling. Okay. Now, authors' quarrels and gossip and also emotions have been, I think, marginalized in the study of print culture. They've been neglected, they've been condescended to, they've been treated as at best of merely biographical interest, as not having really anything to do with how the system worked. This is completely wrong. Emotions have everything to do with how the system worked. Now, of course, these are structured, these structures of feeling, structured by economic and political and other interests, by the crisscrossing lines of power and influence, by the flow of cultural capital, by all kinds of things. But they're not determined by those structures. Nothing in the business relationship existing between Dickens and Bradbury and Evans, for example, can account for how that relationship went sour and got ripped apart in the summer of 1858, leaving these deep fissures in the London literary journalistic world. Nothing in the structure of that relationship can account for that. It all has to do with his intense emotional life, his feelings for Ellen Ternan, his feelings about his marriage, and his consequent fury at what he considered the betrayal of a friend. Recovering information like this, like recovering the lost voices of Victorian oral culture, is very hard to do. It requires extensive use of manuscript sources, all of them, almost all of which remain offline, as well as a lot of unfamiliar printed sources. I think that reconstructing this is going to require that we use all these wonderful new tools that you're used to me, a lot of people who come to RSVP are used to me talking about these great new electronic tools, almost none of which I use for this book, by the way, but that we combine those tools with these manuscript methods to start continuing to pool information that will help us explicate these relationships. The Dictionary of 19th Century Journalism is a great start on it, a major effort to begin pooling some of this metadata. Eileen Curran, now in her 80s, continues the work of the Wellesley Index, wants to hear from all of us. But I think we need to keep doing this, to do this hard work of manuscript work especially, that will help us piece together these lost contexts. If we can do that, in many ways, I think we are in a position to begin fulfilling the promise of that founding generation of RSVP and the Wellesley Index and Victorian studies. These are, I think, among the journeys that on which we're all embarked. And I'll just say in conclusion that I take great comfort in knowing that however long and difficult those journeys may be, that thanks to RSVP and the good people who sustain it, and our own crucial network of relationships, none of us will have to make these journeys alone. Thank you. Do we have time for a couple of questions?
Yes.
Yeah? Yes.
Thank you for that wonderful talk, and I so love the point you ended with about this pooling of research methods. I want to follow up on a couple of things. You were so upfront about how homosocial a group this is, and also emotions. I mean, Punch is also obviously read by women, appreciated by women, and I find myself thinking, do they ever talk about women?
Oh, yes.
In these
That's why it's in the vault.
But also as readers, ever thinking about their audience appeal, or I know there was at least one woman illustrator, I think Helen Kood is her name, if my memory is working.
There's a Georgina Bowers.
Well, this one, I just run across one or two that she did, because she did a once a week illustration that I also ran across. But do they ever show any kind of awareness of how they're going to be perceived and so on?
Excellent question. Absolutely they do. I mean, and in fact, it was often said at the time that Mark Levin's great accomplishment was in making the magazine suitable for the parlor. I mean, what Punch did, and of course a lot of people now, of course, blame it for this and feel like the more radical satirical papers were squelched and overwhelmed by Punch politically and all this. But the fact is that at the time, in the early 1840s, there was so much scurrility and coarseness, as it was viewed, in the comic satirical press, that it was liberating for many middle-class households to be able to have a comic paper that wasn't dirty or scandalous in some way. So, I mean, when they were talking about women as readers, they were very much thinking about them just being decorous, about cleaning up the kind of talk that you hear about around the table so that it would be suitable for a female audience. And that's really their main concern about women readers. Now, they're also concerned about readers in general, including women, are they going to understand this or that reference in the cartoons, for example? Can we have somebody playing billiards in the cartoon? Do most people know that game? You know, if we say that a horse was scratched in a race, do most people know what scratch means, or is that too much of a slang word? You know, so they're always trying to think about what's going to be not only funny, but really understandable. A lot of what gets printed right next to a cartoon and underneath a cartoon and even elsewhere in the magazine about a cartoon is to try and boost that comprehension that they can't quite do in the image itself. I think a study of gender, of this aspect of the gender roles in Punch would be extremely interesting. And in fact, I'd really like to see people use a lot of these same records and do a better job than me in explicating, looking at all 300 and odd cartoons in a really systematic way to see how the conversations match up with what appeared in the paper. Yeah, David.
Yes, thanks, Patrick. As usual, effervescent and entertaining and enlightening.
Oh, thank you.
I have a comment, but also a question which might be helpful in thinking about the things you've helpfully brought forward. I wonder, you're talking about structures and networks. It strikes me one of the very interesting things that your book deals with, and a lot of work that people in this room have also dealt with, is the kind of networks that we are talking about in Victorian periodical spaces. And it strikes me there are at least three that you've kind of touched on. I wonder whether you can expatiate on how this could be improved or developed for others who are doing this work. It seems to me there's a thing about the literary network, which you've always talked about, the way people work, interactive, and so forth. But the production network, the way publishing and the way the production space it works. So you have Henry Clouse as the printer who ends up doing trade directories, but equally printing a lot of the periodicals for a lot of the London publishers. And I went, but also the thing that seems to be underlying this is also the textual network, the way in which individual authors end up having to multi-write. One minute they're doing a leader for a newspaper, the next minute they're writing a comic cut for Punch. Right. Because that was something that I thought was very striking about your work, was precisely that discussion of those three elements, whether you could give us a pointer or some suggestions about how you see that in future directions, perhaps, for us.
Well, I don't know. I think it is, you have to look at a lot of individual cases. I mean, it's really a case for prosopography. But I think it is interesting that last point you made about having to change tones for different genres. That's really a question of genre, isn't it? Something various people are writing about now. Brooks is especially good at this. And so this is one reason why he's so successful. He can write a silly comic squib for Punch and then turn around and write a leader about some grand political issue for the Illustrated London News. It's also interesting to me that some people, he tries to bring in Eliza Lynn Linton to write some things for Punch, not on the staff, but just as a miscellaneous contributor. And he notes in his diary, she couldn't catch the tone. She could not catch the tone, which I think is a very interesting comment. It would be very interesting to kind of tease out what that means. What is he? It's like being a punchy cut. What does that mean? I'm interested, like you are, in these publishers' networks and these printers' networks. I mean, especially in the early days, the print shop floor is very porous between people who are, like, you know, working the machines and people who are writing for what's being printed on the machines. I mean, Douglas Jerrold comes down and actually sets a lot of his own stuff in type, you know, because he had been a compositor. There are people who are working during the day as compositors and during the night, you know, writing, novels for the cheap press. I mean, it's a very, very interesting, fluid environment that I'd like to know a lot more about. Yeah?
I really liked your approach to talk and punch and gossip. I wonder if you could speculate on how useful that approach would be for other periodicals. And I'm asking because, Silver Starry must be pretty rare in terms of capturing this conversation. My sense is people are interested in talk, but just don't have access to it. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe you see it as being easier to capture.
No, I don't see it as easy at all. And I think it would be a legitimate criticism of call for this kind of work. I mean, to say, oh, well, that's fine. You're dealing with the Silver Diary. We don't all, you know, how many of those are there? I mean, for almost none. But, you know, you can do a lot with other kinds of diaries. You can do a lot with letters. I mean, there's still a lot of letters that haven't been published that have just never seen the light of day. Huge, huge, just bushels full of them. It is hard, tedious work to do, and the payoff is uncertain. But I think letters are some of the best ways. There are some printed collections. I think we need to look closely. And when we do, I think we'll often find that what people are saying in a letter is reported conversation. I was really struck by an exchange of letters that was footnoted in the Dickens letters, and the editors were speculating that Thackeray must have received in writing to Dickens must have received a letter from so and so, and that's what he's referring to. But it was clear to me, just I guess because I'd worked on so much of this talk, that no, Thackeray was reporting to Dickens something he had heard from this man at the dinner table. He'd been asked a question. He was writing to Dickens and said, what should I tell him the next time I see him? I think the more alert we are to the possibility that conversation is being alluded to, not only in print, but in letters and diaries, the more likely we are to catch echoes of these lost voices. But you're right, there's nothing simple or easy about it. That's absolutely true. Oh, I'm sorry. We got to go.
Well, Patrick, I think, if you all don't mind, I can see Claire worrying about
this. Oh, I'm sorry, Claire. I don't want to throw off the whole
conference. Patrick for his talk, but also corner him during the next coffee or tea break, which is right now.
Right now. Let's go have some tea.
And ask the question.
Great.
So thank you.
Can I also just say one thing that I did forget to mention? I've talked to a few of you about internet and wireless access. We have set up individual accounts for every delegate, which you can use for the duration of the conference. You'll need to just go to the main registration desk where you'll be given your individual ID. Once you have set that account up, you can then use wireless Wi-Fi around this main area where the conference has been held. Which also led me to the other person that I forgot to introduce and thank, which is my husband Andy, who is going to be around, who is doing all of the tech. And if you see a strange man pointing a camera at you, it is okay. He is doing it on legitimate business for the RSVP website. So, sorry, I forgot you. And if you need Wi-Fi access, then do go to the registration desk and they'll sort you out with that. Thank you.
When it works. Don't blame me.
I'm so sorry.